What is going on, everybody? Welcome to Unrestricted. I'm your host, Ben Lieber. I hope everybody had a wonderful week. My very, very special guest had the coolest job. I'm telling you, the coolest job. Something that I wish that I could have done. Her name is Major Michelle Mace Curran. She's a former Air Force pilot. She just retired from the United States Air Force, and she also just retired from the Thunderbirds demonstration team, which is the best of the best when it comes to pilots and fighter pilots racing around in her F-16 Fighting Falcon. She's the second only female solo pilot in Thunderbirds history, so she's just making history and blazing trails along the way. She also had 163 combat hours as an F-16 pilot in Operations Resolute Support and Freedom Sentinel over Afghanistan. She grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and she also got a criminal justice degree from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. So for the people around Minnesota and around the Twin Cities, she's one of us. She's basically one of us. She also, like I mentioned, recently retired and is going into the public speaking, leadership speaking role. You can find her at Upside Down Dreams at macecurran.com. Also on Instagram at mace, M-A-C-E underscore curran, C-U-R-R-A-N. And I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. It was wonderful to meet her. She has amazing stories. Her journey is incredible. And I think it speaks to a lot of people about how they set their goals and chase their dreams. So here she is, Mace Curran on Unrestricted. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Good. I'm super excited to talk to you today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited that we're chatting via Zoom and we're face to face. And you know, I respect so much of what you do, and I know that you're a super busy person. So yeah, I'm excited for this little chat that we're gonna have.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to talk to someone that has some experience with the Midwest.
Yes. Yeah. So to let all the listeners know that you are a Midwest gal. You grew up in Wisconsin, small town, and you're a Tommy. For all the people that are my listeners here in the Twin Cities, you went to University of St. Thomas. And so you're one of us, as we like to say in Minnesota, you're one of us.
Absolutely. People always think I'm from Minnesota originally because I graduated from there, and I'm like, oh, Wisconsin, but it's pretty much the same thing. The states I feel like are both home for me. So my sister lives just outside the Twin Cities now. So when I come back to visit, I go there regularly.
Yeah. How often do you get to come back?
It's been crazy with the Thunderbird schedule. It was very rare, but hopefully, you know, one or two times a year as I have more flexibility coming in at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to let everybody know, and I will mention it, I mentioned it in the intro, but you just finished your third year, correct? Third year with the Air Force Thunderbirds demonstration team, and you are the lead solo pilot in the position number 5, if I have all that information correct. And you just recently stepped away, and I guess, are you retired from the Air Force technically, or semi-retired? What's your actual job status within the Air Force?
Yeah, so it's always a little bit complicated to explain. So normally an assignment for a pilot or any of the officers on the Thunderbirds is only 2 years, 2 full show seasons. But with COVID, that threw a wrench in there with hiring and experience levels and all the things. So most of us stayed for 3 years. So I already got a bonus year. So no matter what, it would have been time for me to leave the Thunderbirds and go on to a different unit in the Air Force, still flying the F-16, but just a different squadron. But I had about 13 years on active duty, and we kind of decided for my goals, for our family goals, that it was time for me to leave active duty. So I didn't go all the way to 20, which is what you have to do to technically retire. So I kind of just chose to separate. And I'm actually going to be picking up a part-time reserve job doing Air Force recruiting, which was one of the big missions of the Thunderbirds. So it's kind of a natural transition, and it still gives me a tie to the military. I can still share my story and inspire people. So I'm really excited to start that job, but it'll be very part-time.
Yeah. So that doesn't count towards the next 7 years to get to that 20. So your status right now, you've kind of broken off that process.
Yeah. So to get a full active duty retirement, you have to do 20 years on active duty, but you still can get a retirement through the reserves. So it it gets very complicated. It converts to like a point system, and you have to do a certain number of days per year to have a good year to get a certain number of points, and you have to a certain number of points to get retirement, and you can't get it right away. You got to wait till you're 60. So there's still potential there. It's definitely not as financially rewarding as staying in for 20.
Yeah.
But we kind of weighed the pros and cons and decided, for us at least, that that was the right decision. But the people that go until 20, it's a great deal for them to, you know, be getting out in their early 40s, or if you're enlisted, late 30s, and have a pension for the rest of your life. It's a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah, that's a great deal. But my goodness, U.S. military, 20 years? 20 years to get that? That's a long time. My goodness. And you also spent time on active duty in sort of wartime, correct, in Afghanistan?
Yeah. So you have to already be an experienced fighter pilot to even apply to be a Thunderbird pilot. So I did two full assignments, which were 3 years each. So 6 years total in combat squadrons. And the second one I was in, I did go to Afghanistan with them. But a lot of it was doing exercises all over the world. My first assignment, I was stationed in northern Japan. So I actually lived in Japan for 3 years. So one of the reasons I joined the military is because as much as I love growing up in the Midwest, I wanted to travel all over the world, and it was such a great way to do it.
Yeah, no, that is the one enticing thing. I think a lot of people look, and I'm sure as a recruiter, you hear that from kids all the time, that one of the bonuses is, hey, it's a big world out there. It's a big, you know, and I don't care if you live in the Twin Cities or you live in Dallas or you live in New York, there's still a big, big world out there, and you get to see a lot of it. So I have to imagine that's a big plus for a lot of these young military personnel, cadets or servicemen and women, that, hey, you get to see places like Japan and get to take in the whole culture.
I cannot tell you how many times in my career I found myself in like just these crazy, amazing places where it was surreal. I'm like, what? I'm on an island off the coast of Malaysia having a cocktail on the beach, and I'm here for work. Like, they're paying me to be here. They paid for me to travel here. Like, this is amazing.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you said that, because I get this idea that when you're in those locations, maybe you don't have the time and the perspective to sort of sit back and like really take it in, because you're in job mode. You know, you're probably doing whatever branch of the military you're in. You're probably just doing your exercises, and you're pretty focused on the task at hand and what you're there for. But it sounds like you had opportunities to kind of sit back and kick your feet up and be like, this is pretty damn cool what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, it varies a lot. I mean, on a deployment, like in an actual combat zone, you obviously can't do that. And you work pretty much all the time. But when you're just traveling for different exercises and stuff, there's almost always a day or two here and there where if you make an effort, you can go do some pretty amazing things. Like, we were in Alaska for a big, it's called Red Flag. It's like just a huge like war games type event. And you're working 6 days a week. But that one Sunday, we're up in Fairbanks. That one Sunday, I rented a car, drove 4 hours to Denali National Park, hiked, saw a bunch of grizzly bears, drove 4 hours back, and was ready to go fly the next day. I was like, I'm taking advantage of being here.
That's incredible. Well, I feel like you have to do that at times. I remember, so I work with the Minnesota Vikings doing their sideline stuff. And a couple years ago, we had an opportunity to go to London. And I've never been to London. They're doing the big European games over there. And I didn't pull it off, but I had sort of the same mentality of, I wanted to see Normandy Beach. And, you know, looking at the map, I'm like, well, it's not that far away. So I started poking around. I'm like, okay, I have one free day. It was a Saturday and the game was on Sunday. And I thought, can I pull it off and make this a day trip? And I asked around and asked around. They're like, well, it's going to be, you know, 2 hours to get to the port. And then it's another couple hours to get over to the mainland. And then from there, you've got to find a ride to get to Normandy Beach. And then you're going to want to stay, you know, several hours, because there's a lot to take in and doing all that. They're like, you're going to have to spend the night. I'm like, damn, like, I just have a little bit of time. But yeah, when you're in those kind of faraway places that you want to see and do everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's been tons of times where there's stuff I wish I could have seen and I just didn't have the time. And you just got to, in my case, remember that, you know, the Air Force is paying me to be here to do a job. I'm not a tourist. So it's kind of just a bonus when you get to do those things.
This podcast is supported by my friends at Redmond Real Salt. Let's just get this out of the way right now. Go to redmond.life. That's redmond.life. Use the promo code LIEBER, LIEBER, for 15% off your order every time you order from redmond.life. Redmond Real Salt is an ancient sea salt mine right here in Redmond, Utah. I say right here as in the United States. It's not transported from the Himalayas or South America or something like that. It's made right here in the United States. Mixed with my jug of water, it's how I naturally hydrate every morning. I use it as a natural seasoning in all of our cooking, and I also use the Relight pre-workout mix to enhance all of my workouts. Its purity is simply unmatched. There's no additives. There's no sugar. They only use natural flavoring. Plus, get this, it contains over 65 natural minerals to give your body everything it needs for health, wellness, and activity. It's Redmond Real Salt. Go to redmond.life and use that promo code LIEBER. So let's kind of go back all the way to the beginning. And I think, you know, you have held such a unique position, you know, at the time of, you know, just doing the research and stuff, you know, you're only the second ever female solo pilot for the Thunderbirds in history. And, you know, and really when you look at the start of having women in the Air Force, especially be fighter pilots, it's still just in the very beginning and there's still a lot of groundbreaking to be done, but you are one of those groundbreakers. And so, you know, going back to your start and your beginning, what was the interest for you, and what led you to the ROTC program at St. Thomas, and then ultimately down the path that you're on now?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people imagine me as like a little girl seeing the Thunderbirds at an air show and having like a light bulb moment and being like, oh my gosh, that's what I want to do one day, which I've seen firsthand happen to kids, and is one of the coolest parts of the job for sure. But my small town was not near any air shows. The airport there was tiny. So I had actually never been to an air show, never seen the team fly until I was already selected to fly the F-16. So much later down the road. But I was in high school. I was a really good student. My parents always made sure I made that a priority to put academics high up. So they're also a very, you know, working class family. And they're like, we don't have a college fund for you, but we know that there's scholarship opportunities based on your grades. So like, let's see what the options are. And my dad went to UW-Madison and he was like, hey, I saw those like ROTC cadets running around in their weird uniforms. And they always seemed like they were doing cool stuff. And you have a job right afterwards. And I think they'll pay for school. Like, we should look into it. My first reaction, my knee-jerk reaction was, I don't want to do that. I want to be a normal college kid. Because in high school, you have like this idea in your head of what college is like. You're gonna live in the dorms with like all these new friends, and you're gonna go to parties, all this freedom. Well, I don't remember what he said, but he convinced me to at least like look at the options and see what opportunities were. And I was like, well, if I'm gonna join the military, I've always been really adventurous. I love roller coasters. I was a thrill seeker. So I'm like, you know, flying seems like a cool thing. So like the Air Force seems like it would have things I would like. So let's talk to them. So shorten that up, I ended up applying for a scholarship, got one, went to St. Thomas, which I didn't even know about St. Thomas because it's a smaller school. Yeah, I'd never heard of it. I got a card in the mail from them that was like, hey, our records or whatever show that you got an ROTC scholarship. We have a great ROTC program. We have an amazing campus. We actually will subsidize your ROTC scholarship to cover full room and board and tuition, which St. Thomas is expensive. It's a private school. It's very expensive. And we're like, okay, let's go visit the campus. And so we drove the 3 hours over to St. Paul. And I was like, this campus is gorgeous. It's the perfect size. Like, I still get to be away from home, but it's not like the U of M where you're just like, there's 40,000 of us. It's chaos. So it was nice to see something a little bit smaller. And I just fell in love with it. And I was like, this is where I want to go. And went through the program for 4 years. And like I said, flying also always had like a little bit of a draw for me, but it wasn't for sure what I wanted to do. I, growing up, wanted to be an FBI agent. I was like, I'm going to go work for the FBI. I think I liked the X-Files growing up, which is weird because that's obviously like the most unrealistic FBI show that was ever made. So I was a criminal justice major. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go be OSI, which is like the Air Force's version of investigative services. And then halfway through, we did a base visit where the detachment, the ROTC detachment, took us all the cadets to visit a base. We went to Florida. I saw F-15s flying. I saw them take off full afterburner lit at dusk. So you can see like the flame coming out the back and you can hear it and it like reverberates inside your soul. I was like, I'd never seen a fighter aircraft fly before. I was like, holy crap, forget this FBI thing. Like, what do I need to do to make that happen? And that was it. I was like, okay, this is how you get a pilot slot. This is what makes you competitive, for one. I need to get more physically fit. I need to get better at running. I need to beat everyone else in my class. And I need to make sure my GPA is high and all the things. And it was just like laid out the roadmap and just started checking things off. And it ended up happening.
I mean, that's incredible, because I think, and I've, even from my own experience and talking to other former players and stuff like that, it's so fascinating how you don't always have to have this childhood goal of doing something. You know, you just were laid a foundation. You built a foundation of, hey, I'm going to be a good student. You know, I'm going to be disciplined. I'm going to do sort of like all the right things. And then something's going to click. And for you, that click was seeing, which I think is cool as hell too, seeing those afterburners at dusk, and you're like, that's it. Like, that's what I want to do. And thankfully you built up a foundation of like, okay, I know I can be a good student. I know I'm pretty disciplined, because I'm guessing once you got in the ROTC program, was the discipline difficult for you just being a regular student plus all the other responsibilities? Did that sort of come natural to you, or was that something you had to work on as well?
Yeah, I think college is really stressful for a lot of kids as they transition, because all of a sudden you lose your support network and you're on your own. But the academic side involved a lot of time, of course, but it was never like super difficult for me. So I was just lucky that way. And I had a good work ethic and good time management. The hardest part about ROTC for me was just like getting used to stepping outside my comfort zone and being assertive and like putting myself out there and getting in front of other people. And when they ask for volunteers for something, they want to see leadership traits. And naturally, I don't want to raise my hand. I want to be like a wallflower. I was a super shy kid and I was just like, this is scary. But just forcing yourself to do it and getting over that kind of social anxiety, I guess. And I have a whole evolution of that throughout my career to get to being a Thunderbird and where I am now, that I think is interesting story. But I think that was the hardest part for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, let's go into that, because I think that's I love these stories about where people come from and how they get to the top of the heap and their field. And it's not so much about just the task at hand. You had to overcome some uncomfortable internal things to get to that point as well. So then what was sort of the fork in the road and maybe the light bulb moment for you from a mental standpoint, and from like, hey, I got to push past this uncomfortable feeling of feeling socially vulnerable.
Yeah. So it wasn't something that was just cured instantly. And that I was like, okay, I'm a fighter pilot now, like further down the road, it's like, this isn't a thing anymore. It's still a thing. Even when I was a Thunderbird, much less so, but there were moments, you know, where you wouldn't have a perfect flight, or you would be doing an on-camera interview and you'd stumble over your words or whatever it was. And I would like feel myself blushing and I would like get that feeling again. And I would have that imposter syndrome, the word that's always thrown around, or the phrase that's always thrown around, be like, you know, maybe I'm not that good of a Thunderbird. And honestly, it was never the flying skill that worried me. It was the ability to be the right representative for the Air Force and put the energy, because I'm introverted. So constantly having to engage people and be friendly and be outgoing was very exhausting for me.
Yeah.
And so to always have to do that and always be on, and like, especially as the only female pilot, I was just a magnet. People were always seeking me out and I could never fade into the background. And so that was really exhausting. So I would get very burned out with that, but then I would feel really guilty because I felt that way. I'm like, oh, they should have hired someone else to fill this role, because like, I'm not built for this or whatever. So that was even just, you know, in the last few years. But back in ROTC and in college, it was like much more severe than that. Like, I don't want to speak in front of people or whatever. And honestly, ROTC just forced me to do it. It wasn't an option, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's this or you're not going to be successful in this program. And not only are they paying for school, but also I really want to fly those cool jets. So it got to be like, just push it down, go do it. And it was never that bad. Like, nothing catastrophic ever happened like I had imagined. But you take that into, you know, I did really well in ROTC. I got the pilot slot. I went to pilot training, 25 people in my class. Again, I'm the only woman, which is a common theme in my career. And I wanted to fly fighters. And at the time, the fighter spots that were dropping for each class that the Air Force had available were few and far between. So my class ended up getting two. And I knew I had to be in the top two people that were eligible. And I ended up being number two. And it was like down to the wire, where there was one other guy who was like, we were neck and neck, and it came down to our very last check ride before I was like, oh, I have that second spot. And even then, I didn't know that the Air Force was going to have any fighter aircraft for my class, much less two. There have been classes where they'd only had one. Yeah, so all that happened, and I got an F-16, which was my first choice. So people look at me and they're like, you're crushing it, you're so successful. But I had a lot of anxiety. And then I went to my first combat squadron after learning to fly the F-16. And it was like trying to drink from a fire hose. Not only was I living in a foreign country, which Japan is awesome, but it's culture shock for sure. Mm-hmm. And Misawa, which is where I was stationed, is not anywhere near Tokyo. It's 5 hours by train, almost 9 hours by car. It's a small town. Most people don't speak English. You can't tell, I'm 5'10". I was a giant. I couldn't buy clothes there. Amazon Prime is going to take like a month to get delivered. Like, I don't know. It's just first world problems, but all these things. And so you like show up disoriented, and it's already, you know, so much to learn. And I like struggled through my first few flights there. I feel like I struggled finding my identity in the squadron. I think every young fighter pilot, or probably every person that steps into a high performing career as like the bottom of the ladder, they see that it's like this first reputation that they're going to set for the rest of their career. And they feel the pressure of, how do I act? Am I going to perform like up to standards? So I definitely had that. And again, it being almost all men in my squadron, there was one other woman at that point, and she's amazing. We're still really good friends. There was a lot of like, you have that fighter pilot culture, and it's transitioned so much, even since I've been on active duty. But you have like that idea of like the good old boys club and like dirty jokes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And like, how, like, what am I okay with? What am I not okay with? Everyone looks to me when someone says something, the whole room is like, how are you going to react? Like, I'm like, I don't really care. I like, that's just one more, you know, burden for me as a new lieutenant who's just trying to figure out what the hell's going on, to feel like everyone's looking to me to decide, like, why is that my job to decide if this is appropriate or not? This is the longest answer ever to your question, but
I love it. I love you. Keep going.
Yeah. So Misawa, my first combat squadron, was a super hard assignment for me. When I look back, it was the hardest assignment that I've ever done. I definitely struggled with learning all of the technical data. A lot of fighter pilots are technical majors. Like, when I talk to a lot of coworkers, they'd be, you know, like electrical engineering or aeronautical engineering or whatever it is. I was a criminal justice major, and my brain just isn't great at that technical stuff. So I'm trying to learn. I don't think people realize the depth of knowledge that is required. It's not just flying a jet, but the weapon systems and learning enemies' weapon systems and learning like frequency ranges and how they operate with each other. And there's just a lot. And so the flying part came naturally to me, which is why I did so well in pilot training and learning to fly the F-16, and studying came naturally to me. But then we all of a sudden got to this point where I was like, holy crap, I feel like I'm, you know, in engineering classes with no professor because everyone else is doing the job and I'm just like trying to figure it out. So it was overwhelming. I think I felt a little bit of culture shock. I went through some stuff in my personal life. I went through a divorce while I was there. So talk about a tough place to go through a divorce, living overseas, none of your family's there. I literally just have to call them on the phone and be like, this is happening. And my mom's crying. And I'm just like, I can't deal with you crying right now because I have enough shit going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of that happened in one assignment. So I survived, obviously. Learned a lot. And I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it was torture, because I had amazing experiences there. I made amazing friends there as well. just when I look back at the different little segments of my Air Force career, that one was tough for sure. And then I got an assignment to go to Fort Worth, Texas, and join a reserve squadron. So I was still active duty, but all of the people I'd be flying with except a few other active duty pilots, were reservists. So they were mostly older. A lot of them were, you know, late 30s, mid 40s, some later. And they, how the reserves work for flying squadrons, they get to handpick who they hire because they're going to be there their whole careers. It's not like just a 3-year gig and then they leave. So they want someone who fits in really well. And they had built this amazing group of people. They were like a family. Everyone knew everyone's spouses, everyone's kids. People were friends outside of work. It was just such a supportive environment. It was such a breath of fresh air coming from it. It's not a hit on anyone that was stationed with me in Japan, but the operations tempo there was insane. We would work 12-hour days was regular. You'd usually have to come in on the weekend to prepare for your Monday missions. You were just very burned out, and people are constantly coming into the squadron, constantly leaving because it's active duty. So there's turnover all the time. With the new squadron, there was just a lot better work-life balance, and it kind of was just refreshing. And I think that assignment was extremely transformative for me. I feel like I came into my own. Obviously, all the stuff that happened in my personal life, it was like a new chapter. And I had the time and flexibility to pursue some hobbies that I'd always wanted to do. So in about a year, like 2016 to 2017, that assignment, I deployed for the first time to Afghanistan. I decided, I love the mountains, I always have. I decided I wanted to go to Nepal because it's just gorgeous. And so I booked a trip with a bunch of strangers, never met, flew there by myself. Like was in Kathmandu by myself for a day and then joined up with all these random people and trekked to Everest Base Camp. It was amazing. I can't wait to go again. So I was like, this is stuff I've always wanted to do and I'm doing it. Now is the time. So I did that. I deployed, like I said, got to actually employ weapons and do the mission that I've been training for 4 years at that point, which was very rewarding. I started taking mountaineering classes and like went and climbed Mount Baker and got to like rappel into a crevasse on a glacier and learn how to pull people out. And I just love that stuff. And I just like went full in. I went ice climbing in Colorado for the ice festival. And then this email came across and it was like to the reservists only, but I got their emails as well. And it was like, hey, we're looking for an instructor pilot to go to Poland for the summer to teach their pilots in their F-16s. They also have F-16s, but really nice ones. They're newer than ours. So I like see this email. I'm like, well, that sounds really cool. And I had just become instructor qualified, like seriously, 3 days before that email came through.
No way. Talk about timing. Yeah.
Right. And so I like go out into like our common area in the squadron. And I'm like expecting everyone to be like talking about this really cool opportunity. And I'm like, guys, did you see that email about going to Poland? And they're all like, kids are off school, they have camp, and we have a family vacation, and I fly for the airlines, and I can't be gone. And I was like, so I went to my boss, who was another active duty, he's a lieutenant colonel, and I was like, hey, I know this is to the reserves, but can I volunteer for this? And they were like, yeah, sure. And so that one specifically was kind of a scary thing. I definitely had a lot of doubt, because Poland, I have in this idea in my mind that it's like this Eastern Bloc country that's going to be very foreign to me. And
yeah,
I'm a female pilot, which isn't a factor in my day-to-day flying stuff, but is it going to be a factor for me there? Cause I don't know what their culture is like. I'm a brand new instructor. Am I qualified to instruct in now a foreign country where English is a second language for most of them? All these doubts. And I was like, screw it. Like this has been working really well for me this last year of just being like, this thing interests me, but it also scares me. Ah, screw it. Let's go give it a shot. Like, it was just, it was the most fulfilling. It was going amazing. So I'm like, yeah, let's do it. So I went there for 3 months and it was challenging, but incredible. Like their younger pilots who are around my age were like instantly my friends. They would take me out and show me the city. They threw a birthday party for me while I was there. I was flying this like brand new jet smell F-16 that had like all these cool features that ours don't. And it was just such a cool experience. And then I walked away from that and I was like, well, again, I learned that that totally worked out and it was worth taking the risk of flailing around a little bit and maybe failing.
Yeah.
From that. And, you know, a year later, an email came across that the Thunderbirds were hiring, and that hadn't been something I had really ever seriously thought about. I feel like there's a trend here where it's like, I just developed a lot of habits that worked well for me. And then when things came up, opportunities came up, I like knew when they were the right thing to do. And I had set myself up to be able to take advantage of them. So that's kind of what I tell people. But the applications were due in like 5 days because I had missed the first email. It probably like I auto-deleted it like I did a lot of work emails. Yeah. And I was like, oh, like this, all these requirements, I need letters from generals and I need all my records and I need to get photos taken, all this stuff. And I have till like Tuesday. So I go to my boss. I was like, hey, like, what do you think about me applying for this? He's like, oh, I think you'd be great for that job. Like, let's do it. He was really awesome. He was always willing to have a conversation. His door was always open. And he always wanted to hear, not necessarily like, this is what would be best for the Air Force for you to do. This, like, what do you want to do as a person?
Yeah.
So I loved that. And that was nice to see. And I applied and went and interviewed and I ended up getting hired. And there I was the next 3 years flying for the Thunderbirds.
You know, that all of that is so, it's incredible because of the journey that you had to take so many sort of, I guess, risks for you personally, because there's opportunities to fail sort of at every step of the way. And you go back to Japan, and I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. That really is such a heavy experience, not only personally, because your personal life is not going the way that you want. You know, I can't even imagine all the technical things like you're talking about that you feel like you were inadequate at. And you're like, oh man, like I'm fresh and I've got certain expectations. I'm a woman. That always seems to be sort of percolating right there is always a thing within the military. So you feel like you've got to live up to a certain expectation just because, hey, it's kind of new. You know, they want to see what, all right, you think you can hang with the big boys and, you know, this old boys club and let's see you do it. So you have that expectation. And then, you know, internally, well, I'm not very good with all these other things that these guys are good at. And then you had to live in a foreign place. You had to do all these different things. Like, it's truly incredible that you just made it through those first 2 years and not just survive, but it sounded like you thrived through that process as well.
I developed as a person a ton and it was not easy. There were a lot of days where I was like, you talk about the Sunday scaries where you like start to dread Monday morning. Yeah. I think I felt like that all the time for a while. But I did work with some really amazing people that I still am friends with now. And a lot of them really showed up for me when I was going through the stuff in my personal life, knowing that I'm in a foreign country with no family, no friends outside of my coworkers because I don't speak Japanese.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, this is it. So it's definitely a fishbowl, I guess, to go through a divorce in because everyone sees everything.
Yeah.
But there were some amazing people who really stepped up and like became my pseudo family while I was there. So it was not all bad. And I would not change it, honestly, because I feel like it was such a wake up call. There's so much more that I could do. So I think sometimes you just have to go through those hard things.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it was empowering a lot of ways too, because you probably, you know, if you didn't go through, and I'm just guessing here, if you didn't go through that immense struggle, then would you have developed the attitude of, you know what, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to go to Nepal. I'm just going to do it. You know, and I have two options. Okay, I could fail, but big deal. I might fail. Let's just go try it out. So that attitude of just saying, let's just go try it and see what happens, has really worked out for you later in your career. I mean, that's kind of like how you got to be a Thunderbird. It's like, hey, why not? Why not me? Why not try it? And I think the other part that I find so refreshing, and I know that you're going to go into this world of speaking and public speaking and doing some of these leadership things, which I think is fantastic. And who wouldn't want to hear from someone like you? I do a little bit on the side as well. And a lot of the things that I talk about are that self-doubt component, because I think a lot of people look at, you know, for me as a, prof- you know, f- former professional football player, they think, oh, you've always just kind of had it so easy. And, oh, the guys that play in the NFL, they're just more talented than everybody else there in high school and college and whatever. And for you as a fighter pilot, you always just think like, well, they're the cream of the crop. They're the smartest in the class. They have every intangible that you're looking for. They're just sort of gifted. You know, they're just kind of given these God-given talents, and they knew how to manipulate them and hone them, but they're above and beyond everybody else. But in reality, as you're saying, and in my situation, I talk about self-doubt all the time. Like, it might look like we know what we're doing or that we've got it figured out, but shit, I had no idea if I belonged. Yeah. I was questioning myself every day. I'm like, I felt like quitting all the time. And then eventually you have that other part of your inner voice that kind of sways you the other direction and kind of puts one foot in front of the other. And then, you know, hopefully good things are going to happen. But that's the same thing for you. And I find the similarities and parallels sort of refreshing. And the fact that I don't feel like I'm alone when I go out and give those talks of, I was filled with so much self-doubt. Even now in a career that I'm doing, is this for me? I don't know. There's certainly self-doubt that I deal with on an everyday basis, even though I might try to fake it till I make it.
Yeah, I so much of that resonates. And that's funny because I'm my first big speaking engagement for my new company, Upside Down Dreams, is actually at a school. And I'm talking to like their upperclassmen. And my whole presentation is about overcoming self-doubt and facing fear, and that failure is not an F word. Like, that's not something that we need to like talk about behind closed doors in hushed tones. That every person you look at in a successful role, which might be me in the cockpit of an F-16 or might be a professional athlete or whoever it is, every one of those people, with I would say almost no exceptions, but very few exceptions, they had failures. And rather than letting them get bogged down, they use them as stepping stones to learn from and get better. And one of the things is, especially for like those high school kids, it's like, what's the difference between social media paints this world of everyone having this perfect life that you could never have, and that like everything's perfect. Well, first, it's completely false. We only put out, influencers only put out what they want the world to see. So there's a bunch going on that no one sees. But also, you look at that as a kid or even as an adult, and you're like envious, you're jealous of that. And you're like, I could never have that. Like, they've accomplished, they have all these things I want. They must have had X, Y, and Z to make that happen that I can never have. And you have to realize that there's not like a finite amount of success or not a finite amount of happiness out there, and someone else didn't steal the last one. And most of those people don't have any special magical formula that you couldn't have.
Right.
You just have to flip your brain and stop like feeling envy and be like inspired and be like, what do I need to do to get to that spot? Like, if they have something I really want, like, I'm not talking like the superficial things like, oh, they have nice shoes,
right,
but they're living right. This lifestyle I want. They've achieved this big thing. They're flying for the Thunderbirds or whatever it is. Okay, cool. Like, how would I reach out to them? They probably would love to share their story with me and help me like figure out how to do that. Or how would I do my own research? So it's the difference between a wish and wishing you could have what someone else's achievements are versus a dream and figuring out the steps to make it come true.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so true. And I feel like so many people get distracted by the finish line and what that dream or that wish is, that they forget how to get there. And at the end of the day, it's great to have these goals. I think everybody needs to have goals, and keep in mind that goals, just like in your situation, your goal as a kid was not to be in an F-16, but your goals sort of evolved as you evolved, and it's okay to do that. I think kids sometimes feel stressed, like, well, I don't know what I want to major in college. Like, it's fine. You're going to figure it out. Like, don't get all bogged down by you have to map out your life right now. But I guess the point I'm getting at is, at the end of the day, you still have to just go to work. I think when you feel bogged down by things or things feel overwhelming, just put everything down and just get to work, because that's ultimately how you're going to get there.
Right. Yeah. It's not a magic ticket. It's a lot of people want what successful people have, but a lot of people don't want to do the work that's required to get there.
Yeah. And it's not pretty.
A lot of work.
No. Yeah, it's messy and it's dirty and it sucks, you know. it sounds like you're kind of like me in this regard as well. I was kind of, you know, I was more of an introvert growing up as well, but I find that introverts are probably a little bit more self-reflective than I think extroverts are. And so you're taking in all these things and in your path and your journey, and you really sort of chewed on it, maybe to a fault. I mean, maybe you kind of overanalyze things to a fault, but the fact that you're actually taking a good look at yourself first versus looking at everybody else and seeing what they have, I think that's a plus, you know? So even for the kids and people out there that maybe listen to this, like, well, I'm just kind of introverted. There's no way I can do that. No, you can, because I think deep down inside, you know what it takes to get there. Now you just have to push yourself to do it.
Yeah. It's the cliche of getting outside your comfort zone. You just have to do it over and over and over. And eventually that thing doesn't feel uncomfortable anymore, but now there's something else. So,
are you someone who deals with chronic soreness? Maybe it's sore and achy joints from an old injury, or you're an active person who pushes their bodies, or maybe it's age-related arthritis. Whatever the cause, I have the solution for you. It's called IASO, IASO, and it's a revolutionary therapy device that uses 100-year-old scientifically proven cold laser technology. This South Korean wonder device is the only cold laser device that can be used at home and hands-free. Most of the time, you have to go to some sort of hospital or clinic to get this type of treatment because of the size of the machine. But IASO has engineered this potent light therapy into a device that fits into the palm of your hand. I use my devices all the time on my arthritic knee and my bulging disc in my neck with relieving results. And guess what? It's all done pain-free. Go to wellscare.net or bestbuy.com. That's wellscare.net or bestbuy.com to purchase and start enjoying your life pain-free with IASO. I'm going to ask you a question that is coming from my 10-year-old son. He was over my shoulder as I was getting ready for this podcast and doing whatever research I could find on you, which there is a lot. You've done a lot of interviews and things of that nature. So there's been a lot of features on you. So that's great. He goes, Dad, could you ask her if she's ever shot anybody out of her with her plane? I'm like, that's kind of a forward question, but also at the same time, I'm curious as well. You spent time in Afghanistan. You were in some combat zones. Did you actually pull the trigger on people?
Yeah. So that's such a, that age always asks questions like that. I did a presentation for my niece's sixth grade class yesterday via Zoom in Lakeville.
Okay.
So just down the road. Yeah. And one of the kids was like, so like, what happens if you crash? Like, have you ever crashed a jet? Like, do people die? Like, those are like the questions they ask. So no, it's really fine. So when you say shooting, I was thinking like air to air. So luckily we haven't been in many engagements where we are fighting other jets for a long time. And hopefully it stays that way. Light of recent events going on, right?
Yeah, no
Very
kidding.
Timely. But yeah, in Afghanistan, it's such a weird spot to be in because when you become a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot or, you know, infantry in the military or whatever it is, you know that your job ultimately maybe to kill people, right? Like you might have to do that, but it's not something you think about as something you want to do, or I don't know. You want to achieve the mission is how I would put it. So whatever that mission takes, there are very stringent rules of engagement in place and stuff to protect us from doing things that are, you know, unethical or are hurting civilians or anything like that. So that is very comforting. But if it comes to the enemy versus our guys, obviously I'm there to do the mission all day long. So yeah, in Afghanistan, I got to drop bombs. I did not get to shoot the gun. Some other people in my squadron did. The F-16 does have a gun with some pretty big bullets on it. I think I have some, obviously the podcast listeners can't hear, but I have a shell from it.
Whoa. So,
yeah. I mean, it's probably what, like 3 inches tall. And then the bullet that is not in there would stick out the top, like another couple inches. So we can shoot a lot of those very fast, but I did get to shoot laser rockets, which are like these little rockets. They're like a few feet long. They weigh like 20 pounds, and we have a rocket pod that can hold, you know, 14 of them, and you can shoot a bunch at once, and they're laser guided. So they're very accurate. And I actually did employ those against some people that were planting IEDs. So, I mean, that's what I was there to do. And it was a successful attack. And it was, I don't want to say I was happy or it was rewarding, but I was satisfied that I stopped them from doing that.
Yeah. And does that ever, does it ever cross your mind later on, maybe when you put your head on your pillow, you know, sort of even a successful mission, knowing that you saved American lives? Is there any part of you that's the human side of things just like, yeah, I just ended those people's lives?
I think I've thought about it occasionally. It's definitely not something I dwell on. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy for us up in the air, just seeing things through like this IR targeting pod, to feel very detached from them as humans versus the guys on the ground that are seeing people as they're, you know, shooting. I think it's a much different experience. But I mean, I've definitely thought about that, right? Like, I'm sure those people have families and they have kids and they have moms and all the things, but you just can't dwell on that, because when I see a story about any of our service members who didn't come home and their families and their kids, and like, I'm going to pick that every day. Like, that's what I signed up to do. And, you know, I believe in the mission. I believe in what we have as freedoms in the United States. And I wouldn't have joined the military if I wasn't willing to defend those.
Yeah. Can you explain the difference in how you feel in an active combat zone, sort of your life versus what it was in Japan or Fort Worth? You know, when you're actually in a hot spot and you know that any given moment you could be called up in the air to support or attack or whatever, is it 24/7 anxiety?
No, for sure not like when you're actually on the ground deployed. At least it wasn't for me. But when you're airborne, you definitely feel the gravity of the situation. I mean, honestly, anytime you're releasing weapons from the aircraft, whether that's in training or not, you realize how serious it is, because you could hit the wrong target. Like, a lot of times we would train on a range with guys on the ground who are also training to get ready to deploy, and they're still humans still out there. So if I miss the target, I could still hurt someone. So we always would train like we fight, you know, so we would try to make the situation as realistic as possible. But there's not really a replication for flying at night in Afghanistan. You put your NVGs down and you look below you and there's just tracer rounds and fire. Like, you can just see bullets going everywhere. All kinds of different rounds are being fired at different people. You have, I mean, your farmer who's just trying to defend his farm is firing at someone. You have Afghan forces who are shooting at, I don't know who, ISIS, Taliban. There's so many different groups there. Everyone's shooting at everyone. You look down, you're like, this is just chaos. And I think in an F-16 where we only have one engine, you do have the thoughts like, I would really not want to have some sort of catastrophic mechanical issue here where I had to get out of the jet. I mean, those are so rare. But this is not where I wanted to happen.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a good place to land.
Did you ever face any anti-aircraft shots at you, missiles or anything otherwise that you felt threatened like that?
So luckily they only really had like small arms fire, and they had some smaller artillery, but they generally wouldn't try to target fast movers, mm-hmm, like fighter aircraft, because you just have to track so fast and they know they're not going to hit us. But like helicopters, they were definitely at risk for, you know, like rocket propelled grenades, just like weapons like that could reach them when they're lower to the ground and slower. So yeah. I know even now my husband was in the Marines in Fallujah, and while we were in Hawaii, we went on 2 helicopter rides, and he's like, I hate helicopters. I'm like, they're so cool. They're so fun to fly in. He's like, I just hate them because of that reason.
Well, yeah, I watch all these videos that come out, and I've watched some of the documentaries that people do in war zones, and they do seem like, as much as they're useful and they're needed, they seem like just sort of sitting targets, you know? And I know they can move fast, but as they're picking up and dropping off, they're hovering, or they're on the ground, or their approach is slow. They're kind of slow to get out. Like, I'm watching them with, anxious feelings, like, get out, like go, like get that freaking thing moving out of the sky, because you just feel like a sitting target.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of are. It's, I think every mission they're doing a risk assessment on, you know, what's the environment like, what intelligence do we have, who do we have to help defend us on the ground, and do we have to get in there or not, or should we wait for it to be dark out, or, you know, I think every mission there's a risk assessment going on to determine how much risk they're willing to take to go into the landing zones. But yeah, we were much safer for sure up higher, obviously, but also we just move a lot faster.
Yeah. How often were you in the air in Afghanistan? Was it days between? Is it every day that you're training? How many active missions were you on?
Oh yeah, it's almost every day. I don't even remember how many missions I did while I was there. Maybe like 60 or something like that.
Wow.
70. I don't know. But it felt like it was most days. You'd have a day off usually like every 7 days or so. You might have like a day where you didn't fly. But you would usually do some sort of other duty, like man the radios at the desk or whatever it is, sit alert. You know, we'd have an extra aircraft or two, like all ready to go, and pilots in the squadron that had to be able to get out there and start and taxi within 15 minutes in case something big kicked off and, you know, troops were in contact and needed someone. So you would sit in the squadron all day, just watching movies and doing whatever, waiting for the call, hoping you weren't like going to the bathroom or something when you got
it. Yeah. Did you guys have much contact with the guys on the ground where you're stationed? So let's, you know, going back to the one mission you're talking about where you eliminated those guys that were going to plant IEDs. Is there ever contact with the guys on the ground when you guys either get back to camp and they're like, hey man, appreciate that, like thank you pilots, like is there any sort of that acknowledgement that takes place from the guys that you're helping out and vice versa?
Sometimes I wouldn't say it's happens regularly. Afghanistan is a pretty big country, and we're up at Bagram, and like that mission was like way in the southern part, so I would like never see those, and a lot of times you wouldn't even know who it was. You might get a call sign, but you don't know who that call sign is really associated to or whatever, and so you'll probably never hear from that person or anything again. There occasionally would be stuff that would happen right outside the base that we'd be called to support. And I mean, those guys would run into each other sometimes, or if someone will get wounded and end up at the hospital on base, sometimes pilots that were involved with the missions would like go meet them and go see them and stuff. So it does happen, but there's just a lot going on and, you know, you gotta get ready for the next mission. So I would say that doesn't usually happen, but I think when it does, it's a really cool experience for both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like, I don't know. I know that everybody's there to just do a job and it's chaotic and you're going from one thing to another and all that stuff, but it's fascinating to me how all the branches of the military can come together in a combat situation and help each other out. And oftentimes you don't know who's helping out. And, you know, it would be nice every once in a while, like, hey man, hey, you know that bomb you dropped, like you just saved our whole convoy, and you get some sort of pat on the back and some sort of acknowledgement, like, hey, good work, you know?
Yeah. I think when I hear stories in general from the guys on the ground, I get that whether I was the one doing it or not. Like, I was part of a mission that was really important. And the actual, for the laser rocket specifically, they require a laser to hit the target to guide them in, and you can do it from your own aircraft, but it's very difficult because it's a diving attack, so you know you're pointed sort of at the ground and at night, and it's hard to run your pod and like where the laser is going and lays while trying to like employ the weapon. So we really don't want to do that, so we usually fly with two jets, so one can laser it in, the other one can employ the weapon. But my wingman had his fuel was at a point where he had to go to the tanker and get gas. So he leaves. I'm there by myself. Well, I think I'm by myself. It's dark out. And I'm talking to the guys on the ground. We're like, we know what's going on. We've been watching these guys do this. And we're just kind of waiting for clearance because it gets approved at high levels, unless there's like American troops directly at risk of dying or like taking serious injuries. We have to get pretty high clearance to employ weapons. So we've been waiting for that forever, whatever. I've been to the tanker and back. My wing was like, I got to go. Okay, cool. Of course, as soon as he leaves, the guy on the radio is like, all right, we got clearance. You're good to go. You're cleared hot. And I'm like, oh boy. because we had talked through this whole attack and I was going to laze the weapons in because that can be the more difficult job and I was more experienced. He was going to get to fire the actual weapon. He was a lieutenant. And we're like, cool, we've got this all figured out. And I'm like, well, he's not here. So all of a sudden I'm talking on the radio with the gods approving us. And I'm like, yeah, copy my wing. We've got the tanker. Just give me a second, whatever. And then this voice comes on the radio that I hadn't heard this whole time. And it's like, hey, we're so-and-so. We can laser your weapon in. Well, it turns out there was an army UAV, like an unmanned aircraft above me in the stack. And they had the ability to target things and laser in weapons. So they're just listening to the whole thing. And they're like, oh, we can do it. And I'm like, cool. So I'm like, confirm we have like everything set, like is the laser codes, because they have to match up, all like all this is good to go. And then I like roll in and I'm like going pointed at the ground and it's dark. Like I cannot explain how dark it is at night there. There's just no street lights or anything. So you're just pointed into this like black hole, which is very unnerving. And I'm like about to hit the button to hit, to fire off the rockets. And I hadn't heard anything from them since they had like initially said that they had the target and they were good to go. And we had kind of contracts between us and our wingmen. Like as I roll in, they're going to call like that they're lasing. So it's like peace of mind. We're like good to go.
Yeah.
Cause if it doesn't find that laser, you don't know exactly where it's going to go. And they don't say anything. So I'm like, oh God. So I'm like, I listen to my tapes afterwards and I'm like, confirm lasing. And my voice is like all like stressed out and high pitched. And they're like very calm. And they're like lasing. And I'm like whatever we said and shot the rockets and then like recover the jet. Cause that's number one concern. Don't hit the ground, obviously. And then you're just waiting. And the rockets impact pretty quickly, but for any weapons release, I think temporal distortion kicks in and you're just like, oh no, it missed. Like, I don't see it impacting.
Right.
Like, where did it go? And then it hits and you're like, okay, like target's taken out. Good hits. We're good to go. And yeah, it shacked them and took them out for sure. And then my wingman came back from the tanker and he was like, okay. I'm like, yeah, you missed the whole thing.
Yeah. You missed the whole party.
he was actually really disappointed. He hadn't employed at all in the deployment. And I think it's definitely something that most of us want to do, like actually do the mission.
Yeah.
And especially that first one, you're like, just like want to get this one over with and like have it go well. And he was going to shoot the rockets. And like, it was going to be his night to do that. And we were very sure that this was a good target that needed to be taken out. And he missed the whole thing. So I actually ran into him like a year or two ago, several years after that whole thing. And I still am like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, sorry. I took your surprise.
Yeah, he got to do a lot of stuff later in that deployment. So it was fine. But that of all the things I got to do while I was there, that one is definitely the most memorable because everyone tells you, like the experienced guys in the squadron, you're talking about your first deployment. They're like, it's going to be at night. It's going to be danger close. Your wingman's going to be at the tanker. Like they have like this worst case scenario. You're like,
of it happened to you.
Oh yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, here, this is what they're talking about.
So when you tell that story, what is the time lapse from all that? All the communication, your wingman leaving you, the UAV above you that just sort of chimes in like the voice of God, like what? Who are you? Yeah. Oh, hi. I didn't know that you guys were watching us. And then by the time you deploy your weapons and get out of there, that happens in a matter of how much time?
I don't know the exact amount, but we were probably on station already. So overhead of the targets for maybe like 30, if he had to go get gas, probably 30, 45 minutes.
Okay.
We're just like driving in circles, waiting.
Driving in circles. Yeah,
driving in circles like NASCAR.
Yeah. I'm just in an F-16. No big deal. We're just driving in circles.
I mean, deployments, especially when you're doing close air support and you're not worried about any air-to-air threats, are a lot of very monotonous, just droning, just waiting, interrupted by sudden, very stressful, very exciting short moments. And then back to just droning and waiting. And unless something really, really big is going on, the exciting parts, if you want to call it that, are usually pretty short.
Yeah.
You're like, okay.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Well, it's funny. I've had a chance to get to know when I played in San Diego with the Chargers, you know, obviously, as you know, that's a big military town. And I got to know and talk to some special forces guys that are all there, you know, SEALs and stuff like that. And they're, they sort of joke around. You know, I think, you know, obviously the media and movies and stuff sometimes glamorize it too much. And yes, what they've done and how to get there is very hard, but they're like, when we're on deployment, sometimes it's a lot of just sitting around, you know, and we're just trying to stay busy and stay in shape and stay ready. But yes, to your point, when it's go time and it's super intense, but it might be followed by, at least for some of these SEAL guys, you know, weeks of just sitting around, not doing anything.
Yeah, no, it would kind of ebb and flow when we were there. It would be very normal to like drop a couple times in one flight or like several flights back to back and then have like weeks of flying these 4 to 6 hour flights and just like doing nothing.
That's amazing. Yeah. So your call sign is Mace.
Yes.
So I know everybody, I've come to learn that that's something that's given to you. It's not necessarily something you get to choose. So, so why Mace?
Yeah. So the kind of the whole thing is it's representative of something that you did that was a mistake or something dumb or something they can make fun of you for. It's kind of like a rite of passage, and it's in your first combat squadron. So I got mine in Japan, and you won't even get one until you're like mission qualified. So the first like probably 3 to 4 months that you're in that squadron, you're going through this formalized syllabus, doing a training, like make sure you can do all the different missions and stuff. And once you're done with that, it's kind of like, all right, you are a fully qualified wingman. Like you could go to combat right now. You won't lead the formation, but like you'll be in one jet by yourself and you'll go. So it's a big moment that you've been working towards for years. So at some point after that, the squadron will have a naming and they will kick you out of the room and they will all come up with every story they can think about, all the dumb stuff you did while you were learning, which everyone does dumb stuff because it's hard. So people make mistakes all the time. And they'll like write all these call signs on the board. And some of them will be like absolutely terrible, like things you absolutely would not want to be named.
Yeah.
The Navy actually is really bad about naming their pilots like the most obnoxious call signs. Our general rule in the Air Force is we want people who don't know the story behind it. Like if you're at a large exercise or whatever, and you're going to stand up there as the mission commander for the whole thing and introduce yourself, we want people to like respect you.
Yeah.
The Navy, they like take a completely different, I've met like Booger and Hog Sweat and Teabag and like all these different calls. You're just like, what is the story with that one? But Mace, it sounds pretty cool. So I like feel like it worked out well. People always think I pepper sprayed someone, which I've never done, but maybe someday just to kind of close the circle, knock that out. But it is an acronym. So traditionally we won't share what it exactly stands for unless we're in person over a beverage, but I'll give you the broad scope because people ask me all the time and I've like kind of danced around it quite a bit. But basically I went way faster than I was supposed to go. On one, my second flight in country, and the M stands for Mach. I actually broke the speed of sound, which was not the goal.
Yeah.
And that was not the tactical correct execution. I did not win the mission. I epically failed it. And actually in the keynote that I'm giving to that high school group here in a couple of weeks, talking about self-doubt and overcoming failure and everything, I talk about that specific mission, exactly what the call sign stands for, and how like demoralized I was after that flight. And I was like, holy crap, I'm in the wrong career field. And kind of just the evolution of that through that assignment. And then a lot of the stuff that we've talked about, just kind of how you overcome that.
Yeah. Well, I like it. And I'm sure you make it sound like you are very happy with it because it is a cool name. It's a cool, like call sign. I love it. When we kind of booked this sit down, I don't know if you're going to know my cousin. I think he knows of you. But I have a cousin that is a pilot as well in the Air Force. And I think he was stationed in Texas as well. And his name is Brian Lieber. And he knew of you, but anyway, his call sign is Fletch. Okay. And so I asked him, you know, so what happened? And basically, like to your point, it wasn't something he chose. It was an idiotic moment on his part. I guess in some of the training stuff, he was getting ready to land and he scraped the fletchings on the wing as he was landing. He came in, you know, I don't know, I guess too steep or something. And so he damaged the wing a little bit. And so like, oh, you're Fletch from now on. That was it. I guess it was easy for him to figure out a name, because it was pretty evident and pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's funny because I think everyone like gets attached to their call signs. It would be like someone changing your first name. If someone was like, you can't be called this anymore, we're calling you this now, you'd be like, what? Yeah. But when the event happened that you're named after, it was probably like traumatizing for you. You probably thought that your career was over, or that you were like an absolute failure, or like it was a very serious moment. You weren't like, oh gosh, I'm an idiot. Like it was probably something that kind of lingered with you and you knew was something really dumb that you shouldn't have done.
Well, I can't imagine the feeling of damaging an aircraft. What, your aircraft costs, I don't know,
$30 million.
$30 million. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're not just bumping the bumper on your car. I mean, so when he did that, I don't know the extent of the damage, if they really had to send it off for repairs, but that's a $30 million machine that you just accidentally scraped on the runway.
Right. No, it's a big deal. And that stuff's not taken lightly. You're not going to get like screamed at and penalized and everything, but you're going to get sat down and they're going to look at exactly what happened and why it happened and how you keep it from happening again. And you're probably going to stand in front of the entire squadron and say what happened and why you think it happened and how they can prevent it from happening again. Because that's one thing we're really good at, is debriefing and learning from each other's mistakes. So there's a, like, when you mess up, you fess it up in front of everyone and everyone learns from it. And it's kind of like a no judgment, like no one holds it against you later, but you have to like own up to your mistakes and learn from them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and before we get out of here, which again, thank you for your time. I, in one of the articles that I read on you, it's so funny that through this conversation, I feel like we've kind of shared a lot of the same, you know, similar backgrounds and same similar stories. And I think some of the same struggles internally, especially. But this one I thought was a pretty fun shared interest. So as the lead in the Thunderbirds, in which you were, when you do your vertical role, the one that, for everybody out there, again, on Instagram, it's Mace_Curran. You do a fantastic job of just highlighting the fun parts of your job, especially with the Thunderbirds and being a pilot. And you do your vertical role and you get to choose the music. And you chose, I don't know if it's still or always is or whatever, but at the time it was I'm Just a Girl by No Doubt.
Yep.
And I laughed at that because I'm a huge No Doubt fan. Nice. I was a huge Gwen Stefani fan. I had the biggest crush on her in 1997 at the MTV, you know, beach deal that they always did. And my wife even gives me crap because when she came into concert here in Minneapolis, I was there. I was singing every word. I was fanboying, I guess you say it, so hard. And I'm like, hey, I don't know if you just chose that because you like him or if it was just apropos because you're a woman in the military, but I love that. Like the fact that we share that is great.
No, that's awesome. Gwen Stefani is a badass and I'm pretty sure she looks the same now as she did in 1990, whenever you had a crush on her, which I'm always just impressed by, but it was really just kind of a fun thing. So we do get to choose the music as a team, like not one person, but our narrator, he kind of is like the keeper of all the music. And so we'll go to him and be like, hey, what about this song? Like, where could it fit? And we were just talking about music when I was in training season my first year and all the maneuvers. And I was like, oh, we should use this song somewhere. And it just fits so well. And the feedback I got from people in the audience, they loved it. Like in the autograph line after we would land, and I would have like little girls come up and they're like, we love, like, I'm Just a Girl. That was so cool. Like, so it just stuck and it was something we couldn't change at that point. So it stayed all 3 years. But my position, I've been replaced by a guy that goes by Thunder, who's a guy.
So
we keep joking that they're going to keep it, but I actually don't know if I'm assuming they'll switch it, but I haven't heard any of the new music for this season. So I'll have to ask them what song they went with, but it was fun to have that. And that was my favorite maneuver to fly as well. So that maneuver in general is just like a cool highlight from being on the team.
It's incredible. And I know that the videos probably don't even do it justice, because the altitude that you climb going vertical, I'm sure you can't explain probably the forces on your body and what that feels like to kind of twirl around that like that going vertical. But I'm just, every time you post one of those videos, I'm just like, that is the coolest thing ever. Like, I just, God, I want to do that so bad, you know?
Yeah. The perspective you get, because it's easy, it becomes a job because you do it constantly. It's easy to lose perspective on like how cool what you're doing actually is. But when you get to come in, especially the overwater shows, which I think I put out some cool videos from, like Huntington Beach. It's just so beautiful out over the Pacific at like 100 to 150 feet and somewhere like 600 miles an hour. And you can look out and see people on the beach. Like, you can't see their faces, but you can see the people in the colored umbrellas and all the things. And then they pull 8 to 9 Gs, which is a whole long conversation about what Gs feel like. 8 to 9, it hurts, but you spiral up. And while you're climbing, spiraling, I'm very focused on the parameters of the maneuver, because I'm looking at my airspeed, my altitude, some other things to know when to recover. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on. But when you recover and then roll upright and you look back and you see that corkscrew of smoke going down to this little postage stamp of a show line of what you like just were flying over. And, you know, it's like on a normal show line, it's almost always a runway. Mm-hmm. And so the runway might be a mile long or 2 miles long, and you're just flying right over it. But now you're at 15,000 feet and it's like this tiny little runway down there. It's just such a crazy perspective.
Yeah. It's incredible what you've done in your life. And then, working with the Thunderbirds and all the maneuvers and going upside down, that's probably the most unnerving videos that you post. And because of that, you know, the Instagram algorithm, I get all these pilots that are kind of doing the same thing. And so I'm seeing you guys go upside down. Doesn't look like it's very, very high off the ground. I'm like, roll out of that. Like, it just seems like it's got to be so tense when you're upside down and it seems like you're 100 feet off the ground.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we are about 100 feet off the ground. It's an acquired level of comfort, even for already an experienced fighter pilot. We don't just fly around upside down. There's like no reason to do it. It's uncomfortable. You have to have that lap belt cinched down so tight it's like cutting into your hips. Mm-hmm. And you can't have any loose stuff in the cockpit. Obviously, everything's going to go flying. So you just don't do it. There's no reason to. On the team, when we learn it, everyone's terrible at it at first. It's not something like we're naturally good at as pilots. So we started doing it, you know, very high above 5,000 feet, whatever, as we're like headed to the airspace, getting in, whatever. We'll just like practice it and make sure nothing's loose in the jet before we start maneuvers. And everyone is scared of like being upside down and accidentally diving towards the ground.
Yeah.
So everyone overcompensates for sure. And they'll roll upside down and then they'll push too hard. And so I saw it with my replacement as he was learning. He like watched the jet flip upside down, or I was in his back seat at first, in our 2-seat model. And it's just like so much push, which causes negative G, which causes all the blood to go to your head instead of normally you're trying to keep blood in your head because it's getting pushed down.
Yeah.
Now you get the opposite, and negative G is like very uncomfortable because like all the blood vessels in your head are like super pressurized. You'll see stars. It's like very uncomfortable. So yeah, you like roll and it just pushes and you're just like, oh gosh. And the lap belt just digs into your hips. So you're like, okay, that was enough. We probably just climbed 500 feet. So it takes practice to get the feel of the roll and the catch to keep the jet level. It takes a lot of practice to learn that for sure.
Yeah. Well, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. And so to get it accurate, you're going to be on this sort of the speaking segment and kind of new parts of your life. It sounds like maybe a book possibly coming out. I don't know.
Eventually. Where you are.
Eventually. And it's the Upside Down Dream. Is that I gather?
It's Upside Down Dreams is the name of the speaking company. And then I'm working on a kid's book, hopefully of the same name, but that's all work in progress. Like I said, juggling a lot of things right now, but the speaking stuff is officially starting. And I have a website. It's just Mace, my call sign, MACE, and my last name, Curran, CURRAN.com. If people are interested in having me speak, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that a lot of people, at least around here, can hear this and hear you and know that you're available. And obviously with your everything that you've done and the struggles that you've had to overcome, and I think the important message of just pushing yourself and all those things that we've kind of talked about, I'm hoping that you get a lot of traction. And I hope that through this one podcast, we can keep you busy.
That'd be amazing. It's definitely my dream to get booked for some stuff in the Twin Cities and get to come back to my old stomping ground and see my family. And that would be like the ideal booking for me. So we'll see.
Yeah, we will get that done. And look, if you are ever back in town doing anything, I'd love to grab a coffee with you and meet you in person. This has been fantastic, and congrats to you on everything. I mean, from your time in high school and college, and, you know, understand that you were this sort of introverted person that didn't want to put themselves out there, to being the lead pilot on one of the most impressive, you know, demonstration teams in the world. I mean, you've done a lot, and I know that you recognize that, but I just want to say thanks and congratulations.
Yeah, this has been super fun. I've really enjoyed sharing all those stories, and I hope a lot of people can, you know, be inspired by them.
Yeah. And Gwen Stefani, we're bound together because of Gwen.
Gwen, we want tickets.
Yeah, please. We want tickets. You and Blake, just we'll do a twofer show. You know, it'd be great.
Yeah, so, if you're listening.
Yeah, if you're listening. So thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's going to do it for us here at Unrestricted. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, Mace Curran, for your time on Unrestricted. And please, everybody, if you're interested in booking her for speaking engagements or anything inspirational, we need to get her back in the Twin Cities. She needs to be a Minnesota and Twin Cities fixture back here. So please reach out to her through her website and through all of her social channels. Obviously, you can tell that she's going to be fantastic for your group and your company, your corporation. So I also want to thank my sponsors. I have to thank Redmond Real Salt. Thank you guys so much. For all the Redmond Real Salt products, go to redmond.life. Use that promo code LIEBER, LEBER, for 15% off your entire order. I also want to thank wellscare.net and their cold laser device, the EOSO device. You can go to wellscare.net for the world's only at-home hands-free cold laser therapy device. You can also go to bestbuy.com. You can type in the search bar IASO for your EOSO cold laser device. That's going to do it. Thank you guys, the fans. You guys have been amazing. This podcast keeps growing and growing. Please continue to like this podcast, subscribe, and also to tell your family and friends. So until next time, we'll see you.